Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome back to the Beauty and the Beast Physical Therapy and Strength Conditioning Podcast. I am joined by my co-host, Dr. Ross Childs.
Happy Wednesday and soon to be Thursday once you guys see this. I hope everyone is doing well. How's everything, Adam?
Good. Good. Busy, but good.
Yeah, I'm busy as well. Probably won't be as energetic as last week's podcast, but that had us both worked up. Just a busy time of year. You know, I'm sure you realize now that there's just a lot of planning that goes into your own business, and you don't just worry about today and tomorrow. You got to worry about the next 6 months and then 12 months and tax season's upon us. So that's always fun. We were just talking about that beforehand. So if I seem a little bit slower today, it's just life. I wouldn't mind a vacation. However, I get to the vacation, I don't know what to do with it. So it's just the way it is. But now, this morning, I know we were, or yesterday, we were talking about a topic for today, and really I wanted to think about what patients have been asking me about. And one common theme that keeps coming up, especially with our aging athletes, is the concept of power and speed. You know, especially these aging athletes that I'm talking about are golfers. They're in their off season right now, although some of them go to Florida. And they say, you know, really the big concept in golf right now is club speed. Mm-hmm. You know, and I don't know if you're familiar with the golfer Bryson DeChambeau. Mm-hmm. He's like 250 pounds. He put on a lot of muscle mass, and his club speed gets way up there. Well, now everyone's like, I want to increase club speed. You know, and they wanted to know, is that just aging? Is there something that we can do about it? So I thought that would be a good topic, and not really just applying it to golf, but for anything. So really, the goal of today is how can people develop speed and power without having to do traditional jump training or plyometrics, as we would once call them. So you've worked with plenty of older adults. Do you find yourself telling older adults, and again, I'm not going to define an age as I say older, but what are some of the reasons why you think older adults should not jump?
I mean, if it's somebody that hasn't done much in the way of, and plyometrics is a little bit over the top because plyometrics is more performance-based. I just mean any sort of like quick stretch shortening, whether that's plyometrics in a gym sense or just, you know, jumping, you know. If it's somebody who hasn't done stuff in a while and if it's somebody who has bone density issues.
Yeah.
I realize that's a little bit more on the farther, like more specialized end of the spectrum. But beyond that, it's just whether or not their tissue can handle the explosive force of the load that's put upon them when they're doing plyos, because people don't realize how much force is actually needed in order to do a plyometric where you're changing directions quickly.
Sure.
Or but landing also with more force than you took off with.
Doing it correctly as
yes.
well. That's the other
yes.
important part.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
You know, and I think a lot of older adults naturally just start to shy away from plyometrics or that stretch shortening cycle. And I also think that ties into, and I've had a lot of time to think about this over the years, and we've talked about it before, that oftentimes we see that loss of explosiveness and power correlate with sarcopenia, so the thinning of muscles, but more specifically the type 2 muscle fibers that we talked about. So for those of you listening, just a quick recap of muscle fiber types. We have the type 1 muscle fibers, which are more for muscular endurance. We have type 2A, which can either be power and explosiveness and endurance. And then we have type 2B, which are more geared towards strength, power, and explosion. As we age, we start to see a decrease in the number of type 2B muscle fibers, which is why I theorize that older adults tend to gravitate towards endurance-based activities because they still have the muscle fiber type. Mm-hmm. My thought's always been, we lose the ability to do that stuff because we start having the muscle fibers waste away. We're not as good at it, so then we shy away from those activities. But can we slow it down? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, so when you originally, when you sent me the thing for this topic, I kind of was like, Yeah, this is an awesome topic. And I'm not saying that that changed, but as I thought about it more, my next thought was, well, why can't they jump anymore? Why can't they do any sort of plyometric?
That's goal number one.
Right. And we talked about that a little bit. And I think that, you know, a lot of times people who think, oh, I just can't jump anymore, probably could do some amount of jumping, or at least could do things to work themselves back into it.
Correct.
I think it's pretty rare, and I don't know, you see more people on that end of the spectrum than I do, just because of the type of clientele you and I see, relatively speaking. But in my experience, it's pretty rare to have somebody who, assuming that they don't have bone density issues, they're not going through some sort of really intense treatment, you know, like chemotherapy or something like that that causes bone density issues and connective tissue disorders. Not disorders, but it makes it weaker.
Yeah.
It's very rare that I find someone that can't even just, like, I'm talking like a quarter of an inch off the floor and just land. You know, controlled, obviously. Yeah. We're not talking about jumping off of a box. I mean, just holding on to a set of TRX handles or something to give them balance, bring your butt down, jump slightly, and then land soft.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So that was my original first thought. It's like, well, why? I know that's kind of the point, but...
Yeah, and you know, the goal of this was to hopefully talk about strategies in case there is the person that can't get off the ground yet. You know, what are some strategies that they can work on to build themselves back up? But if all things were considered equal, you know, and the person had no drastic orthopedic conditions, they haven't had any major surgeries, great health status or good health status, doesn't even have to be great, there's no reason why they can't jump. And we have to remember, just when we say plyometrics, everyone just assumes it's a lower body jump exercise.
Yeah.
That's the most common one, but there are plenty of upper body things that we can do as well. And I've shown those to some of the golfers, which they like. I'm going to take stress off their joints. I feel if someone is already jumping, as long as they can maintain it, they can continue to jump well into their older years. Do I think they'll be doing a 30-inch box jump at 80?
Oh, yeah. No.
If they can,
yeah,
super
fantastic.
Impressive. Awesome. Yeah. So will that change over the years? Yep. But are they giving themselves the greatest likelihood or greatest probability that they'll slow down the wasting of their type 2B muscle fibers? Yep. So, but we have to push ourselves that way. And again, you know, this is more for the average individual, the average aging athlete, we'll say. But this can also be applied to other populations as well. So if someone has an injury, you know, especially let's say someone has an ankle injury, there's still upper body plyometric exercises that you can do. And that's really what I want to get across in today's podcast. Because it's more than just jumping. You know, you alluded to that stretch shortening cycle, and that is the key to explosiveness. You know, it's the turnover. How much force can you recoil into the stretch, and then how quickly can you express it? We can still do that as we become older. We can still do that when we're injured. But it's knowing when to use it, how to use it, why to use it, and really that's the goal of today. Now, what are some examples for people that may not know about plyometrics or jump training? Or why don't you just give me three or four examples of a lower body plyometric exercise and two or three for upper body?
Okay, so in terms of lower body, so just a standard squat jump.
Yeah.
Whenever I think plyometrics, and maybe it's just because I work so much with lateral movement with athletes and stuff, I always think hide and jumps, skater jumps, whatever, side to side jumps.
Yep.
And then my other big third one is broad jumps.
Yep.
Because I tend to classify them as, I tend to think broad jump more of a hip dominant jump, squat jump more of a quad dominant jump, and lateral jump just more of a lateral. That's how I tend to classify them. Yeah. Obviously, it's not a perfect one-to-one.
But what I like about that is you're defining it by the dominance of the muscle group that we're using, because I actually, those are the big three I use right away for most people.
Mm-hmm.
But I typically define them as a vertical jump, horizontal jump, and a frontal plane or a side-to-side jump. So it's the same thing. And I always tell people we have to jump vertically and be able to land. This displacement's actually pretty safe.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have to be able to jump horizontally because the landing mechanism is slightly different. Then we have to be able to jump side to side where we're more unstable. And then we can, some type of rotation, 90-degree turn, reactiveness, whatever that may be. So, you know, we're definitely on the same page. So,
In terms of upper body ones, a lot of times if we're talking plyos, I'm thinking things like med ball throws.
Yep.
That's what I use more so for.
So you're talking like a chest pass throw or a rotation throw?
Well, either, but a chest pass, scoop toss. I tend to classify those kind of as like a, you know, rotational front. I classify them very similarly because the idea is still the same. A scoop toss is almost like a reverse. Is almost like a reverse chop. Press is more of like a shot put, or whatever you want to call it, is more of like an upper body push or a rotational push. Those are the big ones that I use.
Yep. I would say probably a dead ball slam, med ball slam, assuming there's not too much bounce and recoil so it doesn't hit them in the face. That's usually the first place that I'll have people start. Plus, I find people generally like getting some anger out with those types. You know, slam it off the ground if it's a stressful day. It really works well. And then I'll go into the rotation throws, the scoop throws. I've seen some people, young. I probably wouldn't use it with an older adult just because of the extension. But you know, when you explode up and throw the ball behind you, I've seen some research that talk about the there are standardized norms per age group. But if someone has stenosis, I'm probably not going to use that with them. But that is another common one that I've seen in practice. But now you and I both agree that plyometrics are beneficial. We also think, you know, older adults should be able to jump. Do you feel like there is some type of foundation that needs to be developed first before we jump into that type of explosiveness?
Yes.
And what would that foundation be?
So the way that I kind of line it up, and I was just writing it down like as we were talking, is so creating the range of motion necessary, mm-hmm. or increasing their range of motion in a given movement pattern.
Yeah.
Getting them control over that new range of motion if it's more than what they're used to, or just getting control in general.
Yep.
We can talk about that more. Strength in that motion, and that strength and control kind of fit together, but like, you know,
it's different, different components of strength.
And then from there is the power and the explosiveness.
Correct. So the reason I asked that question is we've come back to this many times throughout the podcast. We've always talked about how strength is really that foundation. Now, of course, you need a movement foundation mm-hmm. first. And I like how you talked about that today because, you know, people like the functional movement screen people, when you look at their movement pyramid, it's like movements first. You have mm-hmm. to be able to move well. So I like how you put that there. And then there's the control of the movement, because now if we gear towards the National Academy of Sports Medicine, their pyramid has stabilization first. So they're already making the assumption that movement's good. They actually want you to stabilize first, and then you can get into strength. But we both agree that strength is the foundation that needs to be there. Now, I've always been taught that you're not just getting bigger, stronger muscles with a strength phase, mm-hmm. but you're also preparing the tendons and ligaments for what's going to come next, which is typically going to be our power phase. And really, power is defined as strength plus speed. Mm-hmm. With power lifting, you know, some people, it's a misnomer. We think of one rep max, like the squat, bench, deadlift, sumo deadlift, whatever that may be. We're talking about moving fast, you know, get those muscle fibers firing at all rates. And then, you know, from there, I typically put agility in that stuff after the fact.
Yeah.
Because then you're not using as much resistance. And again, there's quick velocity changes, direction changes, things along those lines. So now with plyometrics or the stretch shortening cycle, kind of walk us through what's the important part of that stretch shortening cycle that will offer benefits to anyone, not just older adults, but to anyone. Do you want them moving fast through the loading phase? Do you want them moving slow through the loading phase?
I think it depends on what their experience level is. And I know that sounds like a fairly wide margin, but if somebody, let's take a deadlift or something like that, for example. Mm-hmm. Let's say that you have an older individual who has you know, I don't know, maybe they played football in high school. Maybe they've been deadlifting for in some capacity for 30 years. They come in, they do their deadlifts, the form looks pretty good, and you know that their goal is to increase their explosiveness. Maybe not on day one, but let's say you do it and it looks good for a little bit. For that person, I may be saying, okay, finish with some pace. You know, control it on the way down, but I want you to, in quotes, explode up through the top part of the movement. Maybe a squat might be an even better way to put it because it's easier to think about like controlling down and exploding up. But regardless, same idea. Whereas somebody who is just learning to deadlift, I'm wanting them to make sure that they're doing it under control. That way I know that they're not just essentially controlling it down or falling down and then like creating a stretch shortening cycle, but have no control over what actually happens on the way back up.
It's just momentum induced at that
point. Right, yes,
usually
exactly.
It causes an injury. So, you know, I, in my head, I wasn't sure I was going to ask the question the right way, but you actually answered it how I was hoping you would. So I'm glad that you went down the path that you did. And understanding where people start is the important part. And you gave some great examples with exercises because, you know, this is what I'm hope we're going to go towards today are common exercises that people can do in the gym that don't require their feet coming off the ground. Mm-hmm. You know, how can we make it more explosive for them? So, but it always starts. It doesn't matter what exercise we're talking about. It doesn't matter what phase of training we're talking about. You always have to understand where someone's beginning. You know, we certainly have people that have more experience in one type of training than others. We have some that come in that have no experience. And if you just expect everyone to lift the same way, you know, that's...
a recipe for disaster.
Well, it's like asking a monkey how to fly. I mean, it's just, it's not going to happen. So knowing where to start probably is going to get you to the finish line faster. Because if you start them off too much or too little, you know, then you're not making the progress that you should be making.
And you may even have to backtrack.
Correct.
Yeah.
And all things considered equal, people's feet should be coming off the ground at some point. You know, that's the nice part. That's why I'm actually okay with the aging athletes who still run.
Mm-hmm.
Because regardless of what you think about running, running is still single leg jumping over and over again. I'm not as fond of it when they're heel strikers because there's that small deceleration period when the heel hits the ground, especially if it's out in front of them and they have to reaccelerate. But if someone's more of a midfoot or a forefoot striker, really all they're doing are just single leg pogo jumps every single time they touch the ground. So running into the older years, I think, can still stimulate those type 2 muscle fibers, you know, which is why a lot of them will still have pretty jacked calves, you know, nothing else, but the calf muscles are big. So it's important for people to understand this. Now, also, if someone is not a golfer, if someone, really the golfing is really the biggest one that I'll hear from a lot of people, but probably our average individual is not going to come in saying, wow, I really need to work on my explosiveness. It's very rare. But it's something that we should be educating them on that they still need moving forward. Again, when we look at muscle performance, that is going to include stability, which we work on. It's going to include strength, which we work on. It should include muscle endurance, which we work on, but also the power piece. You know, and then you think, as we get older, we tend to take things out anyways. Let's leave that power aspect back in. So, if you had to pick 3 exercises, not necessarily plyometric, just any 3 exercises that you think are gonna offer the most bang for your buck for most people who wanna work out, which exercises would you choose?
We're talking explosive exercises or just any?
Any exercises right now. Because then I wanna see, can we turn it into an explosive exercise?
So deadlift, pull variations, and I mean, realistically, probably quad dominant variations too. So like squat, deadlift, let's just say chin up.
Okay.
Chin up or row. Let's go row because overhead for some people. But regardless, some sort of pull.
Yeah. So the only thing I would do different, I would take out the pull and I would just add the push up in.
Okay.
So, but we'll talk about that. Now, what's an easy thing that you can do with a deadlift to now make it more of a power exercise versus a strength exercise?
Swing. Kettlebell swing.
Kettlebell
swing. Oh, I'm sorry. Do you want me to stick with just deadlift?
It's a hinging pattern.
Okay.
But I like the kettlebell swing power.
Yeah.
But let's say you didn't have kettlebells. You want to stick with the deadlift.
Yeah.
You've been working on strength. And now you're like, God, we got to get some power and explosiveness on here. How can you manipulate the deadlift to become more of a power exercise versus a strength exercise?
Go faster.
Exactly.
Increase the speed.
If you want to become faster, you have to train faster. Under control. That's the important part. Now, kind of walk us through the process. If someone said, based off of what they're describing right now, I want to be able to go try a deadlift right now. We would just call this a speed deadlift. So mm-hmm. if you guys were wondering, you could look it up on Google. But what are two or three things that you can describe with a deadlift so that the individual can practice this tonight if they wanted to?
So, turning it into a speed deadlift. So, just, I mean, going down under control, coming up fast, and finishing in the same strong, rigid position that you would on a regular deadlift. I don't know if that, sure if that answers it well enough or not, but a lot of times when you start adding speed, that's when people get sloppy on the way back up or at the top of their...
Well, really all you described was your regular setup for the deadlift, but all you just added in was the word speed.
Oh, yep.
So all you're trying to do is just go up a little bit faster than you normally would. Now, the caveat with that is you're probably going to have to drop the weight a little bit.
Yep.
So, and that's usually with a power exercise. Generally, I'm dropping someone's weight to about 80% of what they would do with a power exercise, maybe even 70%. So we do have to sacrifice that a little bit, but again, it's strength plus speed. Might you be able to work your way back up? Sure. But again, we want to be safe, and that's where the under control position comes in. Because again, you're not necessarily going to build max explosiveness using 100% of the weight that you could be using. You'll still get a benefit from it, but now also the risk of injury goes up. Mm-hmm. So we have to be mindful of that. Now, if we take that same simplistic concept that you just added to the deadlift and say the same thing with a squat setup, you know, let's say goblet squat, for example, grab the weight, hold it in front of your chest like you normally do, go down slow and controlled, and then once you get to the bottom position, explode back up. You're just trying to go as fast as you can back to your start position.
Push the heat, push the ground away as fast as you can.
Exactly. And that's all speed training is. Now, if someone is able to do that under control and they can increase the weight, they may do a jump squat. Because that's really the only difference is now having the feet come off the ground. And that's why I also decided to use push-ups in there. Because especially with young guns, usually like a clap push-up is a very common one. So for those of you who don't know what a clap push-up is, go down into a push-up, explosively push yourself up, take your hands off the ground, clap, and then place your hands back on the ground. I don't think it's great on people's wrists, and especially if it's an older adult, but then we just turn that into a speed push-up. Go down nice and slow to the ground. You're loading the muscle, so I usually call it load and explode.
Yep.
Go down slow. You can even pause for a second in the beginning and then just try to push the ground away from you as fast as you can. These are all great, great exercises to start with. You could even do it with, so you chose a chin-up. We'll say a chin-up before we even talk about the row. I'll let you describe the row afterwards. Again, have your hands on the bar, lower yourself down slow and under control, and then try to pull yourself up as fast as you can. So, and I think a lot of people don't understand how easy power and explosive training can be. Because everyone instantly goes for that home run, pardon me, of the jump squat or barbell jump squats, which I just absolutely hate because it's just loading on the spine, especially with an older adult. I would never want that. Axial loading, spinal fractures, something along those lines are bound to happen. Jump squat and trap bar, I'd be okay with because you're not loading the spine. Now, if someone were to do a dumbbell row and wanted to become more explosive, again, what are the cues that you would give them to make the dumbbell row, I'm assuming a dumbbell row or a kettlebell row, how would you make that more explosive?
So it's pretty similar to the way that you said. I'm having them control it on the way down. Maybe it's a two or a three count down, like one Mississippi, two Mississippi, three Mississippi down, just so that I know that they're controlling it. They're not just getting to the top and then letting the weight come crashing down on their shoulder. Little pause at the bottom, and then basically you're trying to, like if you've ever started a lawnmower, you're trying to rip that weight up as fast as you can.
Well, what you just did there is you lumped that exercise into a functional activity. Oh, that was beautiful. I couldn't have done that better myself. But that was the next step. It's like, all right, let's say they do that exercise. I was going to ask you, how do you relate that function? You already ran right with that. So, I mean, that's awesome. I mean, look at the squat, for example. It's like, let's say you're out somewhere and you need to get up quickly. That's all the squat is yep. getting out of the chair quickly.
Yep.
Let's say you have to rush somewhere because of it, or you're somewhere and the fire alarm goes off. Once you realize what's going on, you can explode out of the chair to get the hell out of there. Mm-hmm. The deadlift, you know, who knows, maybe a grandkid has fallen on the ground. You need to get the bike off of them so you can bend forward and pick the bike up.
How about you're a gardener and you have to pick up a bag of soil. Like, that's how you pick up something like that.
Yeah.
You have to deadlift. As much as Osho wants you to get your butt down and chest up the entire time, that's not how people pick things up. They pick things up by hinging, not by keeping your back straight and getting your legs underneath you, in quotes.
Unless you're under the age of 8, you're not going to be squatting with a vertical spine. Just no one has the hip. Even people that have great hip mobility, generally they never keep a vertical spine.
Right.
Kids can. I mean, even if you look at Asian cultures, for example, where they use the resting squat as a primary means for sitting around.
Yeah.
They're not vertical. Some of them can be.
Right.
But they round the spine and they're okay with the quote-unquote butt wink, and no one's complaining about surgery or back pain or numbness or tingling. So these are all just fabricated impairments that we make on people. Now, we talked about three or four easy exercises that someone can do. Well, we talked about more than that. And let's talk about some progressions that you would make with these people. So let's say you start someone off with a speed squat.
Mm-hmm.
What's the next step for them? Let's say they can do two sets of five, really good, great control. What are some ways that we can make that harder?
So in sticking in a bilateral position.
Yeah.
So from there, maybe I've called them like drop squats before. And it's basically you start high. The way that I use it usually in training is to prepare people for a box jump. So their feet start about shoulder width apart. They reach up and they essentially just drop into it. So that's learning to control the down portion. But honestly, if they're able to complete goblet squats and they're comfortable with trying it, that's where I usually, my next go-to is a TRX squat jump.
Yeah.
Something where they can keep a neutral spine, and should they need some help cushioning themselves down into that squat position, they have the help from the handles. It's not, you know, let's say they don't quite have the control or the mechanics to keep themselves from falling forward when they land or just landing awkwardly, that extra thing to give them some balance helps keep them in a good position to land soft. And for them, it's just like come up onto the toes as if you're going to come off and then drop back into it. Come up onto the toes, drop back into it.
Yep. And I wasn't even considering the TRX strap, but that, you know, I use it all the time for the squat. So it makes sense that we would just add it in with a more explosive exercise. Now, you were asking about, you know, did I want you to stay on the path of bilateral?
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about both legs, yes. How would you progress someone from that bilateral squat to now unilateral exercises, and why would you do that?
So unilateral to me is, like, bilateral is fantastic because it helps you, like, find... I always think of bilateral as being used to find strength in kind of the center position. And then I don't have any like research to back this up necessarily, but it's just always the way that I've programmed is finding strength in a bilateral position is so that you can find kind of your starting point and then go to unilateral out from there so that you always have a starting point and you're able to work around that starting point. That's a long way of getting into from there. it's reverse lunges first, just to make sure that people can build the strength.
Yeah.
But one of my favorite things to do are forward lunges.
Yeah.
Because even if they can't, even if it's somebody who has some knee stuff and can't go real low with it, just having to decelerate your body weight and you then use your, you know, glutes and bigger muscles to step back, to me, is super helpful functionally for real life. In fact, I think that a forward lunge, I mean, in terms of what you're dealing with outside of here, is more functional than a bilateral squat pattern, to me.
Oh, I would say so.
Because, I mean, that right there, a forward lunge is, you know, granted, we're talking like older adults, functional, but if you can't control yourself doing a forward lunge, you're going to have trouble with stairs. You're going to have trouble stepping down off of curbs. Mm-hmm. You're going to have trouble with uneven ground. Anything where you are stepping in a way that is going to create more force is going to be difficult for you over, you know, a bilateral, which how often are you actually have 2 feet and need to use them both at the same time in your everyday life?
And it's just, it's safer. It yeah. offers a wider base of support, so that's why I usually start right. people there.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's definitely, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying it's not necessary. I just, like, when you think about walking is technically a unilateral exercise.
Unilateral asymmetric stance.
Yeah.
That's I'm a huge fan of it. I always teach my aging athletes how to lunge because it's the easiest way to get on and off the ground. Most yep. people don't realize that.
Yep.
But I'll ask your opinion of this. Why do you think older adults don't lunge?
Because it's hard and it hurts.
Why do you think it's hard and it hurts?
Because they don't do it.
Oh! You would have thought that we scripted that.
I know.
I mean, that, I already ran it through my head, and everything just worked out so beautifully. Oh, we're such on the same page.
The reason that's scary. Always in my head, because that is the one, it's funny, and maybe I've talked about this on here, maybe not, but like when I'm working with somebody and I give them split squats or lunges or, you know, like rear foot elevated split squats or Bulgarian split squats, whatever you want to call them. Everybody hates those exercises. And what I always say to somebody when they say, I hate that exercise, is here's a little known secret. Everyone hates them.
Yeah.
I was like, I have yet to meet anyone in the strength and conditioning field. We all do them. We like building the strength. But that is the one constant that I've always seen. People are like, oh, split squats today. Damn it.
Split squats and a large volume of walking lunges.
Yep.
I've actually had my butt muscles cramp up in the middle of the workout.
Yep.
It's the weirdest feeling in the
world.
It
is.
Squats.
It's only happened like once.
I can squat all day long. Nothing.
Yeah.
You put me in that rear foot elevated split squat or tons of walking lunges.
Yeah.
And I'll get a butt cramp and it'll drop you to the ground. It's not for the faint of heart.
No.
But now what is the most, just to stay on people hating lunges and rear foot elevated lunges, what's the most common mistake that you typically find with those exercise positions that could potentially be hard on them or cause discomfort?
I don't know if this is too broad for what you're looking for an answer, but usually the setup.
What about the setup?
Their feet are either way too far apart front to back or way too close together front to back.
Correct. Yeah.
It's more often that they're way too close together, but I have had plenty of instances where I've had to tell people to bring their feet closer together because they're like, I can't get any lower, I don't know why. And their back leg isn't even bent because their legs are so far front to back.
Basically, they're just doing a hip flexor stretch.
Right, and you're like, well, yeah, of course that hurts your hip flexor on the other side. You're almost in a split.
Yeah, bring your freaking leg down and you'll be much better. But also, I like the too narrow of a stance.
Yeah.
Because then you get the person, the knee shoots out way over the toe, the heel comes up.
Mm-hmm.
Man, this doesn't feel great on my knee. I'm like, well, your knee just shot out 15 inches.
Right.
I'm like, where's your heel right now? Well, it's on the ground. No, it's not. It left the ground 4 minutes ago.
Right.
So widen your stance. I usually will tell people, when you're in your bottom position, your knees want to relatively be at 90 degree angles, yep. front and back.
I try. I mean, obviously you can't do this with everybody because not everybody has the strength to do it. But as much as I possibly can, I try to teach the split squats from the bottom up.
Yeah, I think that's fine. And for some people,
I've
also put two Arex pads under the back knee
yep.
to give them a little buffer zone. But the other mistake that I see a lot of people making, not so much on walking lunges, because people just usually will do momentum induced and then mm-hmm. their stability sucks. But with a rear foot elevated split squat, or even just a regular split squat, is they weight shift backwards.
Yeah.
They keep the weight on the back leg. I don't get why my knee hurts. Your knee is in an unsupported bent position and it's supposed to act as a kickstand, and now you've...
the back knee. Yeah.
You've
yep.
relied on the back leg to catapult you forward.
Yeah.
It's like you have to weight shift forward, feel the front leg engage, and then go down and come up using 90% of that leg in the front compared to the back. All of a sudden you shift them forward and it's like, oh, my knee doesn't hurt anymore. Yeah, I know. Because you're not using it as a stabilizer and a mover at the same time. The front leg does what it's supposed to. The back leg does what it's supposed to. And then switch. Oh, what do you know? It doesn't hurt. Yep. Because now you're not ending up in those end ranges. And now we can progress your strength. Which that's also a position where I've had people do plyometrics before. Mm-hmm. You know, rear foot elevated, make sure they're stable. And then have them pop up and land in the same position. Especially for control, once they hit the ground, stick the position.
Yeah,
you know, that's the important part. And I know we got kind of off track. The people that we're pointing these exercises towards are probably a little bit different than, you know, the aging athlete that we're talking about
yeah.
today. But, you know, for those of you listening, it's a goal to get you to, you know, because again, there are a lot of great benefits. Just like strength training, plyometrics also increase the tensile load of tendons, which decreases the likelihood of tendonitis, tendinosis, tendon ruptures. You know, we also have to remember we tend not to do as much dumb stuff as we get into our golden years, as if like, because we've talked about before, the highest rate of tendon ruptures between the ages of 40 and 50, and typically it's males, and males still think they're 10 feet tall and bulletproof at that age and go play pickup basketball without warming up, and then they rip their quad tendon or their Achilles.
Yeah.
And then typically we get into our 60s, 70s and older. We don't just go and play pickup basketball and, you know, or we stretch or we learn to. We become a little bit smarter and we see the rate of tendon ruptures come down. But we can also strengthen that to decrease the probability even more. So that's another benefit to these plyometric exercises. Now, let's say someone comes in. They specifically state to you, I'm an aging athlete. I love being as strong and as explosive as I can. I feel like I'm losing explosiveness, but I'm dealing with a knee problem. I can't jump.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so let's avoid lower body stuff. Where are you starting with plyometrics to still give them benefit of the stretch shortening cycle?
I mean, if we can't do, are you saying we can't do anything really fast, or?
We can still do fast stuff. You just can't do the traditional jump squats or speed squats, or we'll even take out deadlifts right now.
Mm-hmm.
What are other things that you can work on that can still work on explosiveness?
So, I mean, that's where I'd come back to, like, the TRX squats, even if they're, like, slow body weight. Even if they're, sorry, let me rephrase that. Even if they're, like, slow on the way down, fast up body weight squats. Even things like pogos. If they can handle it. Some people with knee issues, that's still tough. And pogos it's just what you imagine. It's just like little toe flicks
yep.
off the ground.
I'd go sit to stand squat.
If
there's yep. a leg problem, because at least they're supported at that point.
Yep.
And you can adjust the height of the seat.
Yep.
So I think that'd be fine, because all they have to do is lower themselves down. Even using their arms to get themselves into the seat.
Yeah.
Because then they have to gain force to get up against gravity. So I'm certainly fine with that. But if someone said, I have an active knee issue right now,
mm-hmm.
but I want to work on explosiveness, that's probably a time where I'm going to say, all right, now we're doing ball slams. Because
yeah.
I can keep
yeah.
both feet on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're doing a ball slam correctly, or a dead ball slam, whatever you choose to call it, it's really more of a hip hinge.
Yeah.
So really there shouldn't be a lot of knee bending other than when you bring the ball overhead to basically lock yourself out, triple extension. Then you unlock it, but you're driving your hip back. So I think that's a very safe one for yeah. a lot of people. And especially with...
You do like a squat to chest pass too.
Exactly.
Like against the wall.
Yeah. There's one patient I'm thinking of right now. It's got to be early 70s. Golfs all the time. Mm-hmm. He has great range of motion, but I'm not going to give him a jump squat. And he was the one going to Florida and says, you know, what's something I can do so that I can start, you know, beating my friends as a group of them that play golf together? And I said, well, number one is you can increase your speed because they're not working out and this guy already works out. Well, how do I do that? Because I don't run anymore. I don't do this. I don't do that. So I brought him out and started showing him some ball slams. Mm-hmm. You know, one, he had fun. He enjoyed it.
Yep.
But then I explained the concept of, okay, this is why we're doing it. You know, yeah. You got to think about your club speed. And he knows that the golfer, DeChambeau, that I talked about, I said, you're basically loading up, which is the backswing, mm-hmm. and then you're slamming the ball down, which is the front swing, or the fore swing. I don't know what we would call that. And that registered with him. So very safe exercise. A rotation throw with him, I would probably avoid. Mm-hmm. Reason being, right now, even though he plays golf, I would need to make sure that he has rotation at his hips, his thoracic spine. Again, being that he's slightly older, I don't want that necessary quick rotation mm-hmm. coming through his knees or his back just yet. I need to get him ready. You know, and that's probably I would do more of a chop and a lift with mm-hmm. rotations
yep.
to gear him up for that.
Yep.
You know, making sure how's that feel. Even the old torso twists that they used to do back in the day, coming straight across.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Giving a little bit more speed there.
Yep.
I'd be fine with that. And then as long as that was fine, then I'd go into the scoop throws. I'd go into regular rotation throws. And he just had a blast with it. And he said, well, how long do I have to do this now before I start seeing the benefits of it? How long, if someone started plyometrics today, you know, the speed stuff we talked about, not jumping, how long do you think they need to do it for consistently before they'll see that carry over into everyday life?
I mean, depending on what you're doing, it can be relatively quick. Will it be lasting? Not necessarily. I'm talking quick, like a couple weeks, not like the day after you do it for the first time.
Yeah, I'd say if you do it consistently,
yeah.
4 to 6 weeks.
Yeah.
You know, if you stop it after 4 to 6 weeks, you know, laws of reversibility, it's going to go right away. So you have to keep some type of explosiveness there. You know, every 6 weeks, I'd say just pick a different exercise. So if you do ball slams for the first 6 weeks, then do speed squats for the next 6 weeks, then maybe you take 6 weeks off to give your body a break.
Right.
Then you come back and do speed deadlifts, and you come back and do speed push-ups and keep alternating. I think that's a great way to do it because you're not overloading anything.
And I think what's cool too is, and I had never really thought about, I mean, granted, now this is, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago that I heard this, but I remember watching one of the first things I remember watching when I first started coaching was, I don't remember which thing from Gray Cook it was, but him talking about how, I mean, now it seems obvious as to why, but at the time, it was a big paradigm shift, that explosive exercises tends to hold strength you've built. So, like, if you got really strong deadlifting, if you then get really good at, let's just say, power cleans or whatever, or kettlebell swings, if you have a heavy enough kettlebell, that you can keep a good portion of the strength that you built by doing the explosive exercise, even though you're not doing the strength exercise. To a point.
No, but I can
not
I can
forever,
see that.
But yeah, like
but
for.
But I'd say if you got away from strength training, or if your goal was not pure strength in that phase, and then you switched to power, even for 12 weeks, you could probably still come back, retest your one rep max, and you'd probably still be within 90%.
Right. The reason that I brought that up specifically is because if you take the chop to med ball throw example that you gave, so the first couple weeks, your exercises may be doing some stuff to open up your hips and your thoracic spine, sideline, whatever, doing that with some chops or some reverse chops for a couple weeks.
then let's say that that cleaned up the movement enough that you could safely start doing different types of scoop tosses and shot puts and things like that. Well, after a little bit of time, you probably don't need to do your mobility and the chops and raises and the med balls. You can just do your mobility and then go straight into the the med ball throws. Mm. So, like, I think people sometimes see this and think, like, okay, so now I have to do my mobility, and then I also have to do the strength work, and then I also have to do the explosive work that mimics the strength work. And for a while, there is going to be some overlap, but once you get into it a little bit more, and once you know what in quotes, feels right, and once you've gained competence in the movement, you don't have to do as many of those in-between steps because the strength is there. You just have to make sure that you can still express the same range of motion and then express it fast.
Yeah.
And it's different with a med ball throw or something like that because you're not – it's not like, you know, doing a different type of power exercise that's heavier. You're only moving a ball that – if you're doing scoop tosses or shot puts, it really shouldn't be more than like 6 pounds. Mm. You're moving something that unless you're doing excessive reps, you're chance of injury is really low, assuming that you've put in the work ahead of time.
Yep. Well, and I think the way you described it with people continuing to layer on more and more components, that's unfortunately a detriment that everyone suffers from at every phase of their training because they just assume I need to keep doing more and more and more and more. So in the beginning, when we're helping someone to develop habit, to develop a solid foundation, it's like, here's step one, here's step two, here's step three. What they don't understand is, wow, I've become really good. I can jump right to step two and go into step three, or maybe I need a little of step one, skip step two, and oh, look, now I can actually go to step four. So, and even then, when you look at like power stuff, we don't need hours worth of power exercises. You know, if I'm structuring a workout for someone and it's a strength phase, I mean a power phase, the power stuff goes first because it's neurologically taxing. So meaning that the body has to increase the firing rate of the motor units, which what's more fatiguing to the actual motor units is now going to be the actual structure of the muscle. So it's going to go power first, which may just be one set of med ball slams or squat jumps, three sets of five.
Mm-hmm.
That may all I do that day. And then I go to my strength stuff second because that may be a 5x5 working at a certain percentage of my weight. Then if I have any endurance stuff, I would put that last because now that increases the fatigability at the very end. Whereas I wouldn't switch it around. I wouldn't go endurance strength followed by power because your body's just going to be gassed by the time you get
You're either going to get hurt or you're not going to be able to express true power.
No, and then at that point, it's not even worth focusing on it because you're just already too fatigued. So, but I think that that's something that gets lost on a lot of people. They either add in too much or then they also don't understand the aspects of programming.
Mm-hmm.
Not that we'd expect the average person to know that, but it's one of those things that can be the difference between having a great workout session and getting max benefit versus a subpar, and you run the risk of injuring yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So we do have to be mindful of that. Now, if someone were to, let's see, we've already talked about a lot of the exercises and a lot of the, not really resources, but you know they should have a solid idea at this point of what they can work on. How long in a phase should someone really keep power exercises in? Do you think it's something that they should work on year-round? And if so, how can they structure it?
I mean, speaking from when I'm working with athletes, I don't know. I think there should be some version of it pretty much all the time.
Yeah.
Power, if I remember correctly, is the pretty much the quickest is the thing you lose quickest.
Correct.
So I don't remember the percentages and stuff, but I know that that is what you lose the quickest. And it's something that you always need to have. And it also can be
less challenging on, like you said that it was neurologically taxing, but if you have somebody that's like an in-season athlete, you can usually get more out of that athlete having them do three or four power exercises. Like let's say that they have to do some ridiculous amount of conditioning, they have practices all the time, like they don't really have time to do like a full scale lift. Doing some explosive stuff is better than doing, in my opinion, is doing better than doing more strength stuff if they have a lesser, to a point.
I would say so too, especially if we look at the likes of, say, like a hockey player in season. I think they'll get more out of their power exercises too. Plus, the load can actually be lighter.
Right.
But they can still use very high intensity.
Exactly.
So I would certainly buy that. I also agree that some component of power should be kept in the program year-round. And because of that, neuromuscular control and stabilization, even if you're not trying to increase the weight every single time, I also think these power exercises can be a great warm-up to the strength stuff. So even if you just took the bar and worked through certain movement patterns and moved the bar fast, you know, put on 40% of the weight that you're going to do. So I definitely see it as a if you're not focusing on power, it can be used before everything as a great warm-up. Because there are other ways that people structure exercises, and you've probably seen them in the past. It's like, all right, do a set of squat jumps, then go right into a heavy squat, because in theory, you've primed the motor units and you're going to lift heavier weights. Now, that's advanced programming. That's not for the average person to go try. But now it's like, all right, if I put the bar on my back and I do three sets of five on the squat, I go down slow and go up fast. That's a power movement, because you're moving the bar fast. And I have not put any weight on it. The weight of the bar is really all that I need. So I think that's a great way to use it. And then if you're saying, okay, now I have barbell rear foot elevated split squats, you've now primed the nervous system, even though you're going from a bilateral movement to a unilateral, you still have primed the muscles. Now the quadriceps can say, hey, load and explode. The glutes, load and explode. The core, load and explode. So I think there's a year-round benefit in that we shouldn't just focus on, okay, we're at week 16 now. This is where we get into the power stuff.
Right.
You know, we can add it in day one if we wanted to. You know, I also like med ball slams as a core exercise. You know, start them off a little bit slower. At first, I teach them how to do it without using the hip hinge. So come through and stop yourself. And then as they show me that control, now it's, okay, now drive your hips back and slam the ball into the ground. So I'm working on it without working on it, if that makes sense. So also very, very important. And then if someone wants to get into the jumping aspect of it, you know, again, jump squats, I think, can, once you're warmed up, can be another great way to express your heavier squat. You know, it doesn't have to be the heaviest or highest jump ever, but jumping up onto a 7-inch box, you know, if you're not used to doing that, that's very taxing on your legs. Mm-hmm. You know, there are times where, like, take sprinting, for example. That's usually the one time that my quads feel really just gassed out the next day. If I haven't squatted in a while and then I throttle it, it's definitely my legs are just gassed. And then, of course, with split squats, my glutes usually just go into full-blown spasm. But we've talked about that enough. All right. Are there any other aspects of power development, explosiveness, and speed that you think we need to touch upon or...
No, I mean, there's always more stuff you can talk about, but I think we did a pretty good job of going over most of this stuff. The one thing I do want to point out, just because you brought it up, and because I know some of the people that are listening at home and will be, so you talked about doing one and then the other, right? And then you followed it up with saying it's more advanced programming, and here's why. 30 squat jumps followed by 5 heavy squats is not going to end well.
Recipe for disaster.
We're talking 3 to 5 good jumps, whether they be box jumps, whether they be depth jumps, whatever they may be. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, good, don't go out and search them and do them. Because if you don't know what a depth jump is, you probably...
Don't start without having someone there to supervise.
Yeah, that is not something you want to do without somebody who knows what they're doing supervising.
we're talking 3 to 5 of the power exercise followed by maybe 3 to 5 of the strength exercise. If you start ratcheting those volumes up, A, you're not going to get true power, and B, your chance of injury increases significantly.
Yeah. I mean, once your speed drastically slows down,
yeah,
it's time to call it.
Yeah.
So if that's 1 rep, 2 reps, 5 reps, you know, that's the goal. I would much rather see someone do 10 sets of 3
yep.
for the power exercise
absolutely.
Compared to 3 sets of 10.
Absolutely.
You know, and then I'm okay at that point if we did, you know, 6 sets of 3 on strength and then mm-hmm. I did 3 sets of 10 on endurance.
Right.
I'm okay with that.
Right.
But again, it's, you know, it's easy for us to say we've been doing this for so long now. We can spit this stuff out without even having to think about it. So hopefully we've been able to break things down for you guys as easy as possible. I know we went off track a little bit when I was talking about butt cramps and lunges and all that fun stuff, but you know, we're wild cards here. You never know what you're going to get. But really the focus of today, we should be lifting explosively. We should be trying to keep as much power as possible into our older years, because if not, then it's use it or lose it. And unfortunately, it's very hard to get it back the longer we don't use it. So, you know, set yourself up, good form, lift the weights a little bit faster, and you'll be surprised with the benefits that you actually get out of it. But you guys know the drill at this point. All the information is going to be listed underneath in the links between Ask Ross Anything and Gray Method and the email if you have any questions for us. And we're always looking for ideas as well. You know, in the next couple of weeks, we may have a guest speaker coming in, so we'll be sure to get that information out if you guys have any questions that specifically pertain to that. But other than that, we'll talk to you guys next week and have a good one. See
you guys.